Lawmakers worked throughout the holiday weekend, but we're still at day 699 without a budget. We'll update you on the latest from the State House with IPR's Brian Mackey and WBEZ's Tony Arnold. Plus, a new Illinois hate crimes bill just passed both houses in Springfield last week. We'll talk to the two lawmakers who sponsored it. The bill now heads to Governor Rauner's desk. And how are veterans throughout Illinois faring?
So you get the whole gamut from, absolutely great to worst thing you could ever come up with. And so that means it's broken somehow.
That's Dave Davis, commander of the American Legion Post in Rockford. He spoke to WNIJ as part of a week-long series they're doing on veterans affairs in Illinois. WNIJ's Jenna Dooley joins us to tell us more. That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. The latest news is next. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. I hope everyone had a safe and relaxing Memorial Day weekend. We start every week with a look at the latest in state politics. Where are we at today? Well, it's day 699 without a state budget. It was a busy holiday weekend in Springfield. Democrats in the House are facing tough choices on taxes and a proposed budget. Automatic voter registration is headed back to Governor Rauner's desk. And Chicago Mayor Rahm Emanuel's gun bill passed the House only to get blocked in a procedural move. Perhaps you were not paying attention to any of this over the holiday weekend. Now is your time to catch up on everything that's been going on in Illinois politics. Here to help us through this are two gentlemen who were working through the entire weekend. Brian Mackey with Illinois Public Radio, WBEZ Chicago's Tony Arnold. Hey, guys, welcome back to the 21st.
Hello, Nyla.
Hi, Nyla.
So let's get started. First of all, last week the Senate approved a budget plan. Can you kind of catch us up? Brian, you want to start with what happened over the weekend?
Yeah, there was the House came in on Sunday. There were hearings, discussions, caucus meetings, which is an internal meeting among House Democrats where they discussed a variety of potential ways to end the state budget impasse, or at least, figure out a way to get some more revenue, taxes, tax money coming into the state of Illinois. And the big takeaway from that is that at least as it stands now, if the reports are to be believed, only 46 Democrats would support some version of what the Senate had voted on as a tax increase. That is not enough to get it passed without Republican votes. Republicans right now say that, with the governor, need a series of what the governor calls the turnaround agenda or political reforms. They need to have those passed before the Republicans would get on board with this tax increase. So essentially where we are is we're still waiting, and there's a lot of behind closed doors maneuvering going on.
Yeah, Tony, I was going to ask you about that. Brian was sort of giving us the schedule, the public schedule of events. Do we have a sense of what's going on? Is there movement? Is there conversation between Republicans and Democrats? Do we have a sense that there's kind of workings going on in the House or discussion? Or is it always kind of the big question where Speaker Madigan stands in all of this?
That's still the question, and Madigan hasn't really been seen publicly on this. Traditionally, the way that this, May 31st is an annual end of session, so that, like, there's this big climax that gets built up here to the next to the end of the month every year. And every other year, if history is any indication, at least since Rauner's taken office, there's been leaders' meetings where Rauner and Madigan had these closed-door meetings. They both come out then and say there's no deal, if they even talk to the press at all. And this year, it's been a little different in that...
In what way?
The Senate passed its own, budget bills and bills that the governor wanted. Some of them had bipartisan support. Some of them didn't. The budget bills did not. But, they did it on their own. And now the question is, what's the House going to do with this? And there are no leaders' meetings going on. Madigan and Rauner are not talking. So it's at least in the way that they have been in the past. Instead, there's been these talks where Madigan appointed four members of the Democrats to meet with Republicans. Well, then they come out and say, we are willing to meet anytime, any place. The Republicans appoint their four leaders, and they say, we're willing to meet anytime, any place. There's been no meetings.
Okay.
And so that's why we are waiting to see what they can't even do. I think the Democrats, as Brian said, you know, they only have 46 votes on the Senate package. So the question on the Senate budget. So the question is, do the Democrats even know what they want to do? Granted,
right.
The clock's ticking. There's not much time to figure that out. Technically, I will say they have until June 30th. Because that's the end of the fiscal year, but it takes more votes to pass a bill after Wednesday.
Yeah, but
right.
That
Brian,
may be
explain
a feature,
why that is.
Tony,
go ahead. Yeah.
Yeah. So the Illinois Constitution. We're going to get into the weeds of Illinois constitutional law here, but it says that if you have a bill and you want it to take effect immediately, it has to pass by May 31st. Otherwise, you need a supermajority. It basically says you need more people to vote for something if you want it to take effect right away. And with a budget, it doesn't do anyone any good if the budget doesn't take effect until the end of the budget year. You need it to take effect at the beginning of the budget year, so that's why. I think that there's a view among some Democrats, well, if we wait until after that deadline, then Republicans will be forced to come to the table, and there can't be any of this, well, Democrats could have went alone because they have enough votes. There are a lot of people here who have been skeptical on the Democratic side of Governor Bruce Rauner, saying that, you know, they wonder if any amount of quote-unquote reform would be good enough for him. I mean, House Democrats point to the fact that they passed a change to the procurement rules in the state of Illinois, which say how, you know, goods and services are purchased. This has been something that people have wanted done a lot for a very long time, particularly in the higher education world has complained about these procurement rules. And the Democrats are saying we're doing these things. We're trying to meet the governor partway. But the governor says, well, it's not really good enough. It could have been a better thing. On the other side, you have Republicans wondering if Speaker Madigan is really sincere. Yes, he met with the governor a month and a half or a month ago.
Yeah.
I lost track of when exactly that was. And now they have this back and forth. Well, the Democrats have four people that they'll meet with the governor's chief of staff.
Well,
the governor's chief of staff will only meet with one of those people. And like, who cares about if you're just an average person out there wondering when they're going to come up with a budget? I'm not sure that this means anything to
well,
you.
Well, that's what
you
I was going to ask
say,
you something, Brian. Because, yeah, what was – remind us what was in the Senate bill. Like, what was it? What did pass the Senate? And what are the nuggets of that that people need to pay attention to from a budget perspective that are likely to maybe pass in the House? Or do we even have that agreement?
Well,
let's start with what was in the Senate.
Yeah.
Okay.
So what was in the Senate was an increase in the income tax rate from the current 3.75% up to 4.95%, although that was retroactive to January. So it actually would be kind of almost collected double for the rest of the year. And that would give an effective tax increase of, like, I've seen numbers as high as 5.8%. So that's the income tax. There's also an expansion of the sales tax to dry cleaning, tattooing, piercing, services that are currently not taxed in Illinois. A lot of our neighboring states tax services. Illinois has not. We only tax goods, food, TVs, that sort of thing. That would expand that service tax. It would also impose a tax on things like Netflix, satellite television providers. And so a wide variety of taxes. Now, Democrats will say we negotiated these with the Republicans. The Republicans were willing to go along with these taxes if we also did those other things that they were looking for in terms of business laws and political changes. But the Democrats ultimately ended up going it alone on that in the Senate. And so that's the House is left with this kind of as Tony said, do they go it alone themselves, or is this all just sort of like we're going through the motions until we can get to another stopgap before the new fiscal year starts?
Tony, do we have any sense of what the political calculation is on this? Or, you know, do you feel like Democrats are always saying, look, we're trying to do something? At least Senate Democrats can say that and they have that political cover. Do you sense that there must be a political calculation in this?
There always is. There has been for 2 years. That's why there's no budget, but they do pass a budget for kindergarten through 12th grade education. That's a political calculation. I think, you know, it's one of those things where if the Senate, you know, I think what I heard from the Senate Democrats is, well, okay, are you going to beat us up over not having a – we're going to get beat up over not having a budget. So we might as well do the budget, and this is how we can do a balanced budget. Yes, it's tax increases, but it's a balanced budget. Now, are you going to beat us up over higher taxes? Well, maybe that's preferable to beating us up over not having a budget.
Not doing anything.
That's been the mentality, I think, that's driven in the Senate. And now you're seeing how the House is grappling with that. They're going to get beat up by the House Democrats will get beat up no matter what, because they're House Democrats and it's Republicans in the nature of things, and they're tied to Speaker Madigan. And we already know that the Governor Rauner is going to be making Speaker Madigan the boogeyman for any Democrat, really, in Illinois, whether they're running for governor or whether they're running for a House seat. And so the question then is, how do we – Do we want to get beat up over again voting to raise these taxes, or do we want to try to meet with Rauner on any of his demands over this budget, whether it's workers' comp or property tax freezes, regardless of whether we think it's a good policy or not? You know, it's been going on for 2 years, and has anything changed? Well, the only thing that's changed really, politics-wise, is that you're seeing the cuts to some of these, you know, the universities, the social services that haven't gotten paid, since January 1 right now.
Right.
And as those start trickling out throughout these districts, you know, these representatives, these incumbents are going to start seeing more people in their own districts giving them a harder time. And I think that's why they're just trying to figure out, how can we get out of this mess? Because there isn't going to be a clean way, no matter any way you cut it, to get out of what's the current state that Illinois is in.
It's WBEZ Chicago's Tony Arnold. He covers state politics along with Illinois Public Radio's Brian Mackey. We're talking about what has happened over the weekend in the State House. And I just want to ask both of you about non-budget issues. There's two things that I wanted to talk to you about. First, Governor Rauner vetoed a previous attempt to bring back automatic voter registration to Illinois. Now there's another version headed back to his desk again. Is this different?
It is. They've made some changes that they say, the supporters of this say, that they believe will satisfy Governor Rauner's previous concerns about this. It did have pretty strong bipartisan majorities in both chambers, if I remember correctly, when it passed.
Yes, that's correct.
And so the supporters of this are optimistic that the governor will actually sign it into law this time.
Has he given any indication, Brian?
I frankly don't. I have not asked his people about that, so I can't say. But I have talked to some of the supporters who have worked on this issue, and they say that they were working with him, and they feel confident that he'll sign it this time.
It's an indication that Republicans voted for it, so that's a good indication that where Rauner stands too.
And Tony, I wanted to ask you also another measure that the governor supports, something you've been reporting on a lot. Lawmakers in the House yesterday passed legislation that would mean tougher sentences for repeat gun offenders. What exactly would this legislation do?
It imprisons someone who has a repeat gun offender longer. Basically, they'd be sentenced up to 14 years on their second illegal use of a weapon charge. And if they were found, assuming they were found guilty, so it's a longer prison sentence for them. This is a very controversial and sensitive subject for a lot of African American lawmakers, who say that this is just going to target and keep people, black people and Latino people in prison even longer, which is already the primary population of Illinois prisons. So how does this address really the root causes of gun violence? They argue it doesn't. They also say that there's no data that show that this actually does anything to prevent gun violence. What prevents gun violence, they say, is actually making arrests. In Chicago, for instance, the police department doesn't have a good clearance rate for the gun violence issue that's going on there.
When you say clearance rate, what do you mean? Can you explain that to everybody?
I just mean police actually making an arrest and the person actually getting convicted that charge. That's what that means. And so there's a lot of cases out there that are basically unsolved in Chicago.
I see. But now this is something Chicago Mayor Rahm Emanuel supports along with Governor Rauner, though, right?
Governor Rauner supports this. Chicago's mayor supports this. Chicago's police superintendent supports this. Emmanuel and the police superintendent for years, even the previous police superintendent, have been pushing for legislation just like this, and it's not passed. It's not just passed. It's not only been unpopular with African American lawmakers in Illinois, but also downstate lawmakers. It's been unpopular in the past because the NRA has opposed this traditionally, saying that just because maybe
I have strange bedfellows in this, huh, Tony?
There are. It's the politics of guns, and it's, you know, it brings different groups of people together. This time, though, the NRA remained neutral on this bill. They didn't take a position for or against it, so you saw more downstaters supporting it, which is why it ended up passing yesterday the House.
Explain what happened after it passed?
Well, there's a lawmaker from Chicago's south suburbs put a procedural hold on the bill. This was seen as basically a hostile action, I suppose, because he doesn't support it. And so he put this hold on the bill that prevents it from going over to the Senate to be voted on there. It's seen, I think, as a temporary situation. The sponsor, the person who's carrying this bill, House Leader Jim Durkin, Republican Leader Jim Durkin, he said that those will take a vote today to override that hold, and it should be a temporary move, basically, to delay this bill. Given that it's, you know, 2 days left, though, there's always some sort of drama that comes up. Maybe this is the bill that causes even more drama. We'll see what happens when they have to take this vote on this hold today.
Don't
expect too much of it.
Sure. We'll have to leave it at that, Tony, because we're out of time. But that's WBEZ's Tony Arnold. I want to thank IPR's Brian Mackey. Thanks for being with us, guys. We'll look forward to your reporting over the next couple of days.
All right, thanks.
Good to talk to you.
The 21st is made possible by the Library at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, showing and preserving significant collections and digitally archiving irreplaceable information so that it is forever accessible to students, faculty, and the community at large. The University Library at Illinois.
When the Veterans Choice Program rolled out in 2014, the goal was to reduce wait times for veterans seeking medical care. Although $16 billion in federal money was poured into programs and veterans were supposed to be able to receive care outside the VA system, the results have been mixed.
That was the fastest time I've ever got a prescription.
When it first came out, it was kind of a disaster, because the VA leaped into this program without doing a heck of a lot of research and getting their ducks in a row.
The VA is in a mess, and I don't know how you dig that mess out, but privatization or veterans' choice will help alleviate maybe the backlog.
We need to have the confidence that we're not going to get stuck with the bill.
So you get the whole gamut. From you know, absolutely great to worst thing you could ever come up with. And so that means it's broken somehow.
The wait time, even though the VA may be beyond 30 days, we can often get a veteran in for care in 40 or 45 days, which is before the private sector can get them in.
Those were the voices of Al Hoagland, Bob Gucci, Sandra Davis, John Klein, and Dave Davis of Northern Illinois, and Alan Bridges with the VA Hospital in Madison, Wisconsin. That audio was collected by journalists at our 21st partner station, WNIJ, in Rockford, DeKalb. They've been reporting on Veterans Affairs. It's a five-part series that's coming out this week. Perhaps you heard the story this morning on one of the stories this morning on Morning Edition. WNIJ's Jana Dooley and Susan Stevens joins us now from their studios. Jana, Sue, welcome back to the 21st. Thanks for being with me.
Good morning.
Good morning. Jana, let's start with you. What was the initial idea? Maybe you can explain to us behind a lot of what you guys focus on was the Veterans Choice Program. Can you explain to us a little bit more about that rolled out in 2014?
Well, previous to this project, I'll be honest, I had never heard of Veterans Choice before. It was earlier this year, NPR, National NPR, had done a series looking at an investigation analyzing wait times. So in 2014, this program was established to speed up the time it took for veterans to get care. And you mentioned a massive influx of money to the Department of Veterans Affairs, the breakdown about $10 billion going to basically get veterans appointments outside of the VA. There was also $2.5 billion to hire new doctors and nurses within the VA system. The idea was that veterans were suffering as they were waiting to see doctors, so lawmakers wanted to do something to reduce those wait times. Well, NPR found that even with all of that money, wait times didn't necessarily improve.
Right. So nationwide, we didn't see wait times improve. What did you all see when you looked into the data in Illinois?
Yeah, we wanted to localize it and give a Midwest perspective. We were hearing some of the national trends. And I should mention this program was working for some people, but it was implemented very quickly. So of the thousands of cases NPR looked at, wait times didn't necessarily improve. But as you mentioned, we took a view from northern Illinois. And what we found was a complete mixed bag. Some people, and I should say with Veterans Choice, it was if you had to wait longer than 30 days to get an appointment within the VA system, or you lived more than 40 miles from a VA medical facility, you could use a third-party contractor mm-hmm. and get an appointment outside of the VA system. And in northern Illinois, it's a big gap if you're living in Freeport and need to drive to Madison for an appointment, or Iowa City, or Chicago. So in some cases, this really helped veterans if they needed an eye appointment. They didn't need to board a bus and get to Madison just for an eye appointment. But in some cases, the wait times didn't improve. So they would make an appointment at the VA facility, and they'd make an appointment with a third-party contractor, and sometimes the VA system would end up being faster. Keep in mind, that doesn't solve the problem that was originally set out to fix.
Yeah. So let me ask you, were long wait times at VA hospitals, was that a problem, particularly when we're thinking about veterans in northern Illinois prior to the Veterans Choice Program?
Well, really, yeah. Yeah, it has been. It has been everywhere. Now, we might even actually have it a little better than other areas of the country right here, though, because we have decent access within an hour and a half of two major, and from what I've heard, very impressive, well-run VA hospitals, and those are in Chicago and Madison, Wisconsin. But still, there were people who, you know, with veterans, I think a lot of them just get used to the wait. So they're used to waiting, you know, 2 months to get an appointment. But, you know, they're always looking to be able to have it serve them better, too.
Yeah, let's play some audio here from your series. So you mentioned Chicagoland. So most veterans, so if we're thinking about veterans in northern Illinois, for example, and you guys in your listing area in the Tacao-Brockford area, veterans have to travel to Chicagoland or to Madison, Wisconsin. Both of those programs did receive funding to hire additional staff through the Veterans Choice Program. Let's listen to hear from Carolina Mosley. She's a clinical nurse manager for Hines VA's Hospital's Office of Community Care.
We hired some RNs because I needed some nurses with varied backgrounds to be able to really, really make sure that my patients got the care that they need. We hired some LPNs, and then we have administrative staff.
So, Sue, did those extra hires help shorten wait times? Or does that, as Jenna's saying, maybe it did for some people, maybe it didn't for others?
Again, a mixed bag is what we're hearing. And they did help them get a system in order. That's been part of the problem, is they were presented this idea, they had a third-party provider to work through, and not a real plan. So hospital administrators actually had to construct these from the ground up, and that's where they were able to hire these administrators who were actually pretty good at doing this sort of thing and coordinating with the other medical providers, the private medical providers in the region, and even getting their own medical staff on board with how this works and what is best for their patients.
And is that just because sort of the whole bureaucracy of everything? I think we always hear a lot about kind of the bureaucracy of especially kind of VA systems. Is that part of the complexity of this?
You got the federal government and the military, so yes, you're going to have a bureaucracy. And that was in speaking with one of the administrators, the one in Madison. That was an issue where they're not sure how to work best with Health Net still. There was even a proposal at one point to put a Health Net administrator in their hospital to help them, you know, coordinate even better. That hasn't come through yet, but they're pushing for that as some of the changes as this program continues to develop.
Yeah, so remind us Health Net how that fits into this whole picture.
Health Net is one of two providers nationwide. They're the one that covers east of the Mississippi. Then there's one west of the Mississippi called TriWest, and they are the ones who are implementing the program. So when this was first proposed, the government said we need an outside provider to coordinate all these things. So everything has to get coordinated through Health Net here east of the Mississippi. So any appointments need to go through them.
Mm-hmm. And we're speaking. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Go ahead. Sorry.
Oh, sometimes it would be easier for, you know, some of the people who work in the hospital. Like, we'd rather just deal directly with the other providers, but no, there's still that other layer they need to go through.
We're speaking with WNIJ's Sue Stevens and Jenna Dooley about a week-long series they're doing. Perhaps you've heard the national NPR stories that came out earlier this year about Veterans Choice and the Veterans Choice program. WNIJ took a look at what's happening with the program, particularly in the Midwest and Illinois, for veterans as well, and sort of the just across the border in the Wisconsin area. You know, Sue, you were talking about Health Net. And I wanted to play another piece of audio here because I know that for veterans, especially the veterans you talk to, again, it's kind of this mixed bag. You spoke with John Klein, who works with several veterans organizations in Northern Illinois to make sure they know about health options like Health Net. Here's what he's hearing.
The feedback I've got from most veterans that I've talked to about it is that they're afraid to use it because they're afraid that they'll go to a private doctor and then get stuck with the bill.
So that's for the third party, right, choice that we've been talking about, Sue. Is that what are veterans afraid? Like, has that happened? Has veterans who sought care outside the system, have they been stuck with the bill?
John Klein tells me yes, and he knows people, although he wouldn't tell me who because he feels, you know, you should be talking about that sort of thing medically. But, yes, they have gotten stuck with the bill. And I believe when Jenna was talking with Quill Lawrence about it, too, he also spoke about some people have been sent into collections. And, you know, it's being stuck with these bills that the Veterans Choice has chosen not to pay for whatever reason or
yeah,
has been slow about paying.
Jenna, I wonder, you did speak to NPR's Quill Lawrence about this issue. So this is something that's happening not just in Illinois, but nationally, that this third-party system that was supposed to help is actually, in some cases, making it worse if veterans are being stuck with the bill?
Yeah, and what's happening is, in some cases, if the bill is being slowed to pay, a veteran might get something in the mail, hey, it's overdue, and then they kind of panic and they might pay for it, or they'll go back to what these county-level Veterans Affairs Commission offices, every county often has a veterans coordinator who kind of helps on the ground with veterans who are looking to get into the system, and what they were given was a hotline. We had a gal in DeKalb County, the superintendent who works with veterans who walk in the door and say, I need help getting into the system. So she was saying in her training, they were given a hotline for billing problems. And she said, if that was as far as the training that we got, you know that there's a systemic problem. And that was the issue, communication at all levels. What happened was, in many cases, a veteran got something in the mail, in, you know, years ago, saying you might be available to get this new option for the Choice program, and they might have thrown the letter away. And that might have been all they were communicated. And then these county-level commissions who help line up bus rides to the hospital, they didn't get that guidance either. Like I said, outside of maybe a hotline for billing problems. So we called this series Making It Work because at the front lines, it was all about networking to figure this program out. They're talking to each other. They're sending emails. They're sending phone calls. And I'm talking about these Veterans Affairs Commissioners between counties. So someone in DeKalb might be calling the Lee County person saying, what experiences have you been having? Oh, okay, that's how you figured it out? Oh, well, I'll help the person that I'm working with figure it out. And so that's why we thought it would make sense. They didn't want to leave the veterans they're working with in the lurch. So they're trying to communicate with each other because communication was not done from the ground up.
And so that's what's happening in Illinois, Jenna. It sounds like at least informally different counties are kind of reaching out to each other. They're trying to figure out ways to communicate. Do we have a sense at least that's kind of one thing that's helping in Illinois?
Yes, I think so. I think there's the alternative was to completely ignore this program. But the people, often these people at the county levels, my colleagues Guy Stevens and Chase Kavanaugh spoke with these county level officers. They're veterans themselves. They're going to try to make it work. And so if that means doing their own fact finding to help the veterans that walk in their door, they're willing to do it. They're willing to help work through the bureaucracy because they truly believe, as veterans themselves, this is a benefit that they have earned and that they should be able to take advantage of no matter how hard it is to cut through the red tape.
Well, speaking of veterans, Jenna, you also spoke with recently with U.S. Senator Tammy Duckworth, of course, a veteran of the Iraq War. She's been very outspoken about improving the Veterans Choice Program. And I wanted to play a little bit of what she had to say during a recent phone interview with WNIJ.
I voted for the Choice Program, but it's been very poorly executed. And I'm here now in the Senate working to try to fix the way the bureaucracy was set up around how to implement Choice so that it truly makes it easier for veterans, not harder.
That's, of course, U.S. Senator Tammy Duckworth of Illinois, an Iraq War veteran. Jenna, what is being done at the federal level to try to improve the program today?
That's right. Our editor, Victor Yaling, spoke with Tammy Duckworth. Tweaks have been made. It's NPR's Quill Lawrence told me that's often been in the form of renegotiating the contract with those third-party advisors we talked about. There's also been an extension to the Veterans Choice Program. Last month, President Trump signed a law permitting the Veterans Affairs Administration to spend the remaining funds through January 18th. It was supposed to expire August 7th. They've extended that. Now,
to January 2018, Jenna, just to be clear?
Yes, 2018 has been it's extended because, and it's not to say, oh, this program was working well. As Quill Lawrence from NPR found, it's basically to say if a veteran needs to set up an appointment for like a long-term surgery, they didn't want to get that cut off midstream. So what this does is it keeps people getting those long-term surgeries. But there's still calls at every level to overhaul this comprehensively. The extension was not a seal of approval that it was working. It was just saying we don't want to leave veterans hanging if they've got some surgeries coming up.
Sue, can I ask you, you spoke with hospital administrators at Hines VA in the Chicagoland area, also the VA hospital in Madison. What are they saying? What do they need?
First, that it was a rough start. I think if we talked with them a couple years ago, we would have had hair-tearing out stories coming from them. But they've really settled into it. They've set up their own systems. They've hired their administrators and their nurses, some of those through the extra funding that came through Veterans Choice. And what they need is being able to work better with the third-party administrator, which they also give credit to for jumping in. You know, they had like a few months to set up a system. I had a nurse tell me they went from serving, Health Net went from serving 10,000 people to a million, you know, in the country in a very short time. So
yeah.
Those are the growing pains that they're all going through. So the people I've spoken with see it as a valuable program. They just want it to work right and be easy. Veterans can be suspicious about, you know, what, how a program's going to work, if they're actually going to get what they need. So a lot of it has to do with communications at the veterans level, too. And I know that people are trying very hard and working very hard to do that. And
I'm afraid, Sue, unfortunately, we're going to have to leave it at that because we're out of time. But all week, there's a series that's going to be available from WNIJ. We're going to tweet out all the links. I want to thank Sue Stevens, Jenna Dooley. Ladies, thanks so much for being with us. Thanks for this reporting on Veterans Affairs. Appreciate it.
You're welcome. We appreciate talking. Thanks.
Thanks for tuning in to the 21st. Today, a Portland white supremacist is facing murder charges for stabbing to death two men and wounding a third in what the FBI is investigating as a possible hate crime. That incident occurred late Friday night. The men who died were standing up for a teenage girl who was being subject to anti-Muslim rants. That incident happened the same day that a new hate crimes bill passed here in the Illinois Senate. It now heads to Governor Rauner's desk. The bill was initiated by the Attorney General's office in response to the rise in hate crimes we've seen here in Illinois in the past year. The Chicago Police Department data shows that hate crimes reached a five-year high in 2016. This year, we're already outpacing that level. We're going to be speaking with some of the lawmakers who sponsored the legislation. Let's start with Senator Omar Aquino of Chicago. Senator Aquino, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with me.
Thank you. I'm glad to be on.
Of course, you all initiated this bill some time ago, but I wanted to give you a moment first to react to the horrific events that happened in Portland on Friday. Do you worry that something similar can happen in Chicago?
You know, certainly, you know, unfortunately, these are things that can happen anywhere throughout the U.S. And throughout the world. And so, you know, that's why I'm proud to have supported this legislation, to that the Attorney General had reached out to me and asked me to take it on as the Senate sponsor. We want to make sure that the people of Illinois know that hate has no place here in Illinois, and that we're going to do everything in our powers to protect people from incidents like that.
So can you tell us what's new about this bill? I know there's some technological updates. Can you talk about that? How has technology impacted hate crimes in the way victims are being attacked?
So certainly. So, you know, this bill has about four different components, one of which is to basically modernize some of the language so that some of the things that can happen over social media, like cyber stalking and so forth, are covered within the hate crime language. Another big aspect to this is that it allows for a civil remedy to be brought out by specifically the Attorney General's office to have some civil enforcement authority. So basically, if someone were to be a victim of a hate crime, not only can they get retribution and basically justice through the criminal courts, but also now there would be a tool, hopefully, you know, once this gets signed, that also they can get justice in a civil action as well.
That's Democrat State Senator Omar Aquino from Chicago. He sponsored this hate crime bill in the Senate. It originated in the House with Letitia Wallace, a Democrat from Rockford, who's with us as well. Representative Wallace, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with me.
Hi, thank you for having me.
So, you know, we were just hearing Senator Aquino talk about crimes of cyber stalking and sending obscene messages. It also adds certain acts of intimidation to the list of crimes that can be prosecuted. What does that mean?
Well, it did kind of limit that language eventually as it worked through the Senate. But the type of intimidation that could lead to the threats of bodily harm, I think it's really important for people to feel protected from the things that some others may try to do to manipulate or harm them.
Now, Representative Wallace, you're a former mental health counselor. I wonder, when you were thinking about this and we're thinking about resources that have been cut back at the state level for mental health, do you think that should be? I'm curious sort of your perspective on how important you think it is to be devoting resources to, say, mental health versus, say, creating more hate crime legislation.
Well, I think that actually they're not mutually exclusive. Being the victim or the target of hate crime can actually be quite traumatizing. So I have also worked on measures to make sure that mental health care is funded, that we start to implement more trauma-informed counseling services. But those things tend to, you know, go down two separate paths in terms of the legislative process, but I think that they are both important and both need to be explored and fully resourced.
I wanted to ask both of you, Senator Aquino, Representative Wallace, why you think it's especially important for people of color to be speaking out against hate crimes. I'm thinking right now we're seeing lots of attacks on Muslims, but for both of you, obviously, unfortunately, the Latino and African-American communities are no strangers to these incidents. Representative Wallace, let's start with you.
Well, I do think it's very important that we learn from our history. We have a very clear and plain history of intentional acts of discrimination, intentional acts of domestic terrorism, and also intentional acts of the types of intimidation that we just talked about. We have to learn from that history and move forward and not allow any other group in the future to experience those things. We literally just debated a Senate bill on the floor for creating a council to address the needs of the Muslim community. It just failed. I just looked up at the board as I'm speaking to you today. We've been intentional about some forms of discrimination in our nation's and state's history, and so we're going to have to be intentional about making sure that we no longer allow that discrimination to occur.
Senator Aquino?
Yeah, you know, I would furthermore say that, you know, not just as being legislators of color, you know, but also that we have two legislators with both genders that are representing this and saying that, look, in the state of Illinois, there's no room for hate. And, you know, especially as a, you know, as a Latino with, the, you know, the background in a community that that serves with, you know, many undocumented families and so forth, and a lot of the hateful rhetoric that's coming out of the White House and so forth towards Latinos, towards people of color and so forth. We want to make sure that we're putting laws that are protecting people, making sure that you know, when you live in this land, that you are cared for, and that if you become a victim of a hate crime, that there are measures in place to make sure that that you get retribution and find justice.
Senator Aquino, you mentioned President Trump. Obviously, Chicago, from a leadership perspective, Mayor Rahm Emanuel, City Council, has been very vocal about being a sanctuary city. Do you think that it's even more important now for elected officials to be vocal about being welcoming? Do you think that helps change, counteract, to your mind, some of the other rhetoric that's out there?
Absolutely. Look, when I'm in my district, you know, I go and visit schools and I talk to families and I go all around, and right now people are literally scared to leave their homes because of the rhetoric that's coming out of the White House. You know, and it's important for Representative Wallace, myself, and all that are able to give voice to our communities to say that, look, that's not a representation of what our country is and who we are. We are better than that. And so at every chance that I get, I at least want to make sure that people know that this is a loving country. This is a country that certainly isn't perfect, but we are trying to make it a better society for everyone.
Representative Wallace, I'm also thinking about Rockford, and Mayor Tom McNamara has also been very vocal. I'm thinking about last week's decision to not house a detention facility for ICE. What do you think about, I mean, I think we often hear Chicago, but I'm curious your sort of perspective outside of Chicago, Rockford, other cities, about hate crimes and hate speech and being welcoming.
Well, I am so proud of my mayor and local leaders who have decided not to accept ICE detention in our community. We've organized and fought back against that particular issue, and I'm very excited that we were able to do that. I think we have to really look, as the senator stated, at what the national rhetoric is and how that is impacting so many areas throughout the country and the fear that it is eliciting in individuals. And I think that we've also done a disservice by painting this as one particular community's issue. When you look at the Muslim ban or the countries that were banned earlier this year, seven nations, four of them were on the continent of Africa. We have a large number of refugees from all over the world, and people should be able to feel safe. Our children who are in the schools that we are dedicating so many of our tax dollars to deserve to be safe and feel like they are not going to go home to a parent that's been taken away. And so we have to continue to give voice to those who are marginalized and those who are living under this fear and intimidation. And I'm very proud of my mayor. I'm proud of the county board and the sheriff and everyone who stood up. The sheriff made a different decision because people organized and stood up against hateful rhetoric and going on and eliciting the growth of fear in our communities.
That's Rockford representative representing Rockford in the State House, Letitia Wallace. I want to thank also State Senator Omar Aquino, Democrat in Chicago. This legislation actually was initiated by the Attorney General, and she's on the line with us now. Attorney General Madigan, welcome back to the 21st. Thank you so much for being with us.
I'm happy to be with you, Nyla.
This came out of a summit that you convened earlier this year in February, this legislation. What did civil rights leaders tell you, Attorney General?
Well, we spent a lot of time talking about not just the increased numbers of hate crimes that were being reported, but the fact that there were increasing numbers of hate crimes that were not being reported. And unfortunately, this is an area where if you are already marginalized, when something of this nature happens, particularly in the environment that we're living in right now in our country, people are not necessarily comfortable coming forward and informing law enforcement, in part because they're not sure if they're going to get any justice, and in part because if you're dealing with somebody who is not documented, they've got real concerns about whether or not immigration is going to be alerted and they are going to see themselves or a member of their family deported. So it's it has become an increasingly difficult situation, and one that I felt we needed to address by ensuring that our hate crimes laws were up to date and were going to be able to handle these situations appropriately when they occur.
You know, there are always those who say, Attorney General, why further criminalize already criminal behavior? Because what's your response to that?
My response is that we had to update our hate crimes law to recognize that much of the hate crime that is taking place is now taking place electronically, and that we didn't have certain aspects of the electronic crimes encompassed in our hate crimes law here in Illinois. So we wanted to make sure to be including cyber stalking and these other types of things that take place online as part of our hate crimes bill. So certain acts of intimidation, transmission of certain messages electronically. Again, I think everybody realizes if they spend any amount of time on social media, on the internet, that technology is increasingly being used to attack individuals.
Have you been in contact with the governor about this? I know you've also been asking the governor to restore the Illinois Hate Crimes Commission. I'm wondering now as this bill is headed to the governor's desk, what your sense is. I should say we also reached out to the governor's office to ask if they were going to sign this legislation. They did not respond.
So I have yet to talk to them specifically about whether or not they'll sign this bill. I do believe that there has been a commitment on behalf of the governor's office to be responsive to the needs of people throughout the state of Illinois who are experiencing hate crimes. And so I am hopeful that in this environment, the governor's office will recognize that we really do need an updated hate crimes law in Illinois to make sure that when these incidents occur, we are able to charge them appropriately. Because unfortunately, hate crimes are things that while there might be an individual who is attacked, the intent of those crimes is to put fear into entire communities and to send a message to entire communities about, you know, their worth. What these hate crimes laws do is to recognize that in addition to whether it is an assault that takes place, whether it's cyber stalking, whether it is a murder that takes place, that underlying crime is not the only crime that has occurred. That if the impetus for that crime, if the motivation for that crime is in fact because of hatred or bias, that there is an additional crime that has taken place and that that needs to be addressed by our criminal justice system.
We just have about a minute left of the program, Attorney General, but just want to ask you quickly, are there extra resources going to law enforcement to help them enforce this? Do you imagine there'll be extra resources needed to help enforce this?
I don't believe there'll be extra resources. And in fact, my office, the Attorney General's office, has taken on the responsibility through this new law, if it becomes law, to be able to civilly prosecute hate crimes. And so we're trying to take on some of the responsibility to make sure that there is no additional burden. But unfortunately, right, law enforcement is reactive to the types of crimes that are taking place. When we see an increase in any type of crime, law enforcement has to be there to contend with it. And unfortunately, we're seeing a significant increase, even over last year, in the number of hate crimes that are taking place in Illinois and across this country. And as it was, 2016 was, I think, one of the highest if not the highest years on record for hate crimes.
That's Attorney General Lisa Madigan on the new hate crime bill that has passed both houses of the state house, now heads to Governor Rauner. Thanks so much for joining us, Attorney General. I appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you.
That's all the time we have for today. You can always find past shows on the NPR One app, and our website, 21stshow.org, is where you can find all the resources, everything we've talked about today, as well as links to that Veterans Choice series that WNIJ is rolling out today. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media, broadcasting from the Medill Newsroom in downtown Chicago. Thanks for listening.